Welcome to the show, everybody. It's the Young Turks. It's Tuesday, and this is a very special Michael edition of the Young Turks. We've packed as much Michael as we can have at the table and still have me here to say that at the beginning of the show. So we've got both the Tracy and Wood varieties. Welcome to the show, guys.
Michael overdose.
Exactly. So we've got a big show. There's a lot going on, obviously. We can't get to everything, but there's some really big stuff going on, not just in the police and the criminal justice system, but there's a technological wrinkle to it that I'm really interested to talk about, something that has a lot of ramifications for privacy and those sorts of issues. We've got a potential assault on some regulations on Wall Street. That should be fun. And a little bit of Jared Kushner. He's been a very bad boy again. And so we're going to briefly discuss that. And then finally, we'll get around to the continuing battle over the AHCA, the Republican alternative to Obamacare, and one of its ambassadors, Mo Brooks, who perhaps shouldn't speak publicly anymore about these sorts of issues. But we're going to break all that down a little bit later on. Before we jump into the main stories, anything you guys have been working on, you want to talk about anything like that?
I don't want to announce anything too soon. We have some big plans coming up, so stay tuned going forward with maybe a tour coming along that you can connect with Vet Stan, talk about policing, and empower your own community through art and service and community and transform. And these are some key words that I'm trying to hint out there.
Nothing specific, but just be on the horizon.
And yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on at TYT Politics. We just hired a new reporter, Naomi LaChance, who was formerly at The Intercept, NPR, and other places. So that's
got a big resume.
So that's an exciting addition that was announced just this past weekend in Washington, D.C., where some of us TYT people were for a probably debauched shindig is what I would call it. And yeah, plenty of stories on the horizon for TYT Politics. Also, this is my little pet project that I'm kind of alone in promoting, but please follow the TYT Medium page. We're trying to increase the written presence of TYT on the internet, and I've been doing that. Naomi will probably do some of that. Jordan just had a really good piece that came out yesterday on the Medium page, so be on the lookout for that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that because I just started the process of getting my account on there today, actually.
Excellent. So fortuitous.
Take a look, okay? Because there's both the TYT page and then also the individual pages. Like, you have your own individual page as well.
Right, but if you follow the TYT page, everything will kind of conglomerate.
You know? Yeah, so go follow that as well. Somewhat in relation to what you were talking about, why don't we move into the first story, a really sad story, actually. I want to talk a bit about a teenager named Jordan Edwards, who was murdered by a police officer this weekend in Balch Springs, Texas. There's really no other way to put it. It's a sad story that's developing fast, does not look good for the cops. There you're seeing Jordan Edwards, 15 years old, and the same sort of story that regrettably happens constantly. He was a great student, a great athlete. His loss obviously affecting not just everyone who knew him at school, but his family, absolutely devastated. But we want to break down what actually happened, because the messaging coming out of the cops has been fairly insane. The way that initially they tried to protect the police officer who did this, who's now been put on administrative leave, and we hear is possibly about to be fired. So initially, the night of, this is what the police said about what happened that led to Jordan's shooting.
While officers were at the location, they heard gunfire. There was an unknown altercation with the vehicle backing down the road towards officers in an aggressive manner. An officer shot at the vehicle, striking a front seat passenger.
So right there, very clear. The people in the car were reversing in an aggressive fashion. And it's not coincidence that they use that terminology, because of course, while we're going to get to it a little bit later on, police are not supposed to fire at moving vehicles to begin with. The argument to do so that's often given by police is, it was in defense of my life. They were using the vehicle as a weapon. Now, it came out from the people in the car by their lawyer that that's not at all what happened. And it turned out that the police eventually caught up to the truth as well, because just yesterday, this is what the police were saying.
I unintentionally incorrect yesterday when I said the vehicle was backing down the road. In fact, according to the video that I viewed, the vehicle was moving forward as the officers approached. I'm saying, after reviewing the video, that I don't believe that it met our core values.
So what you had here was a party where there was a report of possible shots being fired. Police go to the location. Some people are in a car, including the deceased, who tries to leave. And now the cops eventually acknowledging that they were not using the car as a weapon. But we get a little bit more information coming out of the lawyer for the deceased, who said Jordan's older brother was maneuvering out of a parking space near the party when they, quote, heard someone shout profanity at them. The person did not identify himself, but appeared to be a cop and was shining a flashlight at the car. They say that before the driver could respond, the unidentified police officer fired multiple shots at the vehicle. And specifically, reports say that it was actually the side windows that were shot out, which again takes away the idea that they were backing up at the cop and he somehow shot out the side windows. Doesn't make a lot of sense. And he was firing a rifle from fairly close range. That's what they're saying now. And it took about a block of driving for the passengers to realize that Jordan had been shot, mortally wounded, died shortly thereafter. And so this is a sad story. Unfortunately, in America, it's not a particularly rare story. Now, the cop was put on leave. He might be fired. He hasn't been arrested. But even the cops are admitting that this does not rise to their core values. To even if you believe that there were shots fired and someone gets in a car and starts to drive away, I don't understand why cops believe that that gives them a license to execute anyone in the car. The idea that you can't call in for help, that you can't track the vehicle, the idea that they have signed their death sentence, even if they were trying to flee, I don't understand why that is always the defense of the cops and they believe that it's acceptable.
I'm kind of having a hard time like even discussing these things anymore. A lot of people that I know don't even watch these videos anymore because we're just watching the same things over and over. And I don't want to see in reports where we say that it fatally struck the front passenger driver, the front seat passenger. Yeah. And like those are the words that we have in our society that aren't encapsulating what really is happening. I want everybody to think for a moment about what this situation is. You're a 15-year-old boy finally going out to a party where you feel like some kind of independence, like you're going to go out into the real world. And when you're at this party, something tragic happens and you hear gunshots and you run to a car and you want to get out of there. And who would anybody even be telling you that you should look to for help? You should be looking to the police. Yeah. And that's not what ends up happening. Instead, an officer fires a rifle into the front seat of the car because maybe he is scared, because we have a society that tells us these things and that cops should be scared and that guns are everywhere. But during that process, when they're leaving, it's not just that boy who was shot. It's not just Jordan Edwards. It is everybody in that car when they look over and they see smoke coming from his head because a rifle round went through their friend because they went to a party and our state-sanctioned officers can't properly respond. Not only is everybody in that car generationally traumatized from this, the entire neighborhood is, the community is. We see it when we go forth. Now, the cop is even traumatized after seeing this. He's not going to understand how to process this. This is going to be a dramatic thing. He doesn't understand how to have fear. He wasn't properly trained to do any of this. And now the 911 caller who originally called because there was a loud noise or disturbance at the pool. Now, when you call 911, you know that the result of your actions ends up being these families and everybody traumatized because of your actions. What does that make you do when you want to call 911 again to actually solve a problem? This is not about people. This is about systems. And I need everyone to really look. This is like a terrorist attack on our communities from their perspective. And what makes it worse is you're paying for that. They're paying for their own oppression at the other end of that. And your silence is condoning it the entire time.
A question that always comes to my mind, sorry, when these events arise is why were the police there in the first place? Because the only way for an event to escalate into some kind of scenario where somebody is fatally shot is that the police need to be on the scene in the first place.
Yeah.
So why were they there? Apparently there was there were reports of quote underage drinking and noise. Now,
dear God. Noise?
I would find it weird for a group of teenagers to not be emitting noise and engage in underage drinking.
Yeah.
So we have to kind of take a step back and think to ourselves, why is it that such huge swaths of the population obviously feel compelled to seek police intervention for the most routine activities? Because if you don't call the police, then there's no chance whatsoever that something can escalate into a deadly incident. It kind of reminds me of the videos that we see with such frequency when a traffic stop escalates into a fatal encounter, right? If the police weren't in the position where they're surveilling people so closely and scrutinizing their behavior on the road without any kind of real public safety interest in mind, then you would lessen the incidence of these things happening in the first place. And I think that's sort of what has to be addressed from a structural standpoint. Otherwise, it's just an inevitability that these things are going to be happening over and over again.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, when you and look, there are programs, we're going to talk in a story a little bit later on, programs that like sort of are supposed to clue in cops to areas where they're more likely to be needed, and so they park themselves there. That can lead to situations like this, sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. There's an inequality to this that, again, like you, it makes it hard to. I know people don't watch these videos necessarily anymore because they can't take it anymore. I understand that. It's hard to talk about them constantly. It's one of the reasons I sort of try to back off emotionally and try to look at it only intellectually to protect myself, because when you do this year in and year out, it starts to take a real toll on you. When you watch the videos of the families who've just had their entire lives ruined because of this terrible, terrible thing that was done. But the inequality of if a call comes out to the cops at a party in this area, it can lead to a shooting. If I had been invited to parties when I was younger and I had gone, it wasn't going to happen in my area. The cops would not go there looking to shoot. It wouldn't actually happen. If I get pulled over by the cops, they're not so scared that their gun is in their hand and they're ready to fire, something that happens all too often. It's the inequality of assuming an area is dangerous, and you pointed out the fear. Fear in America is never more dangerous than when a cop is experiencing it. And they're trained to be afraid, and their fear has fatal consequences.
Their fear has been codified into law as reasonable justification to kill. Understand, a police officer only needs to believe that their life is in danger or someone else is in danger for them to take fatal action legally. So we have codified their fear, and now that they're normally fearful, then we've codified that a fearful cop is normal and can thus kill anybody they want.
And on that point, a really telling aspect of this is that just after the incident took place, the officer who fired the fatal shots was allowed to be spirited off and given time to, quote, decompress. Now, if a normal citizen shot an unarmed person, let alone a minor, and kill them, do you think they'd be just kind of given the opportunity to hide away for a while and get their story straight and, quote, decompress?
I
sort of doubt it. To me, that's a form of what I would call blue privilege.
Yeah. I saw your tweet on blue privilege. I kind of disagree with it in a bit because they do have a privilege, but we kind of take the concept that we should take that privilege away from them. And I don't think that's really probably the best thing. The best thing would be to give everybody those privileges instead of the other way around, just as a put in perspective.
Oh, I agree with that. I just mean there's a whole kind of legal infrastructure in place to prioritize the interests of officers in these kind of situations.
Yeah. And look, there's still a lot hidden about this story. They've said they're reviewing the body cam footage because there were actually body cameras on the scene. They, of course, as they never do, they haven't actually released that footage yet. They haven't even said that they will release it. They're considering it. I never understand how that can be legal, that you cannot provide evidence. That I know seeing footage is not 100% objective. It's from a particular point of view. Things can be dark, but it's information. I think people should have access to it. As you pointed out, he was spirited away. We don't even know his identity. And so in a lot of these previous cases, somebody kills someone. It's unarmed, obviously unjust. Eventually, the cop's identity comes out. We look at the places where he's been before. Very often, these guys have multiple violent incidences. They're shuttled from one precinct to another. Is this guy one of those? I don't know. Tried to find out, couldn't find the identity. So that's another way that he's being protected. I understand there's death threats and stuff like that, but people are rightfully angry and they expect justice. The guy might be fired theoretically, but it looks like even from the cop's point of view, he basically murdered someone without cause, and he isn't being arrested. If that had happened to you or if I had done that, would I be still at this desk? I don't think so.
To drag out the story a little bit longer, what I do always want to try and push everybody towards remembering is that justice from our perception is equality, but that's not real justice in these cases. I know we want to look at the individual aspects of it, but the justice needs to be a changing of the system. So when we watch Tamir Rice and we watch Jordan Edwards get killed, we fight and change the system so we don't allow cops to be that way and operate in that manner so that they work for you. If we just continue to go, okay, we're going to arrest this cop and we're going to put them away for life. Yeah. You still have a system in place which will immediately put that next freeway therapy cop into a position that they shouldn't be in the exact same scenario, and you've done nothing to protect life. We must find justice through changing this system where the police work for the mayor or for politicians. They do not work for you. You must change that paradigm.
No, you're 100% right. And look, in this particular case, the federal guidelines tell cops not to fire at moving vehicles for reasons that I think are fairly obvious, but for some reason need to be trained. A lot of police departments around the country, especially in major cities, do have regulations like that. In Balch Springs, they do not, unfortunately. Perhaps if they had trained the cops to not fire at moving vehicles, then he would still be alive today. But one other thing, obviously the family, not just emotionally devastated, but also financially devastated, because now they suddenly have a funeral. They're going to have legal fees that they have to pay to try to get some sort of even individual justice out of this. And so if we can advance to Graphic 22, there is a YouCaring fundraiser set up by the family. It's the only official fundraiser going on. So if you're interested in possibly helping out the family of Jordan Edwards, that is one way that you can do that.
And another point on the body camera issue, and this actually relates to something we'll talk about a little later. There's no reason in principle why the footage from this incident couldn't be released immediately and to just dispel any skepticism about whoever, the competing version of events and so on. But because the police have pretty close to unilateral control over how that footage is managed, at least in the short term, they're able to just withhold it and not allow it to fulfill what its purpose ostensibly was, which is to increase transparencies. Yeah. That's why, because it's a relatively new technology still, we need state legislatures and actually local and local jurisdictions to pass laws and ordinances, not just advising or recommending that the footage be released on a certain time frame, but mandating that it be released as soon as possible, which I think is an imperative here, given the public notoriety around this incident.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons that when the widespread possible use of body cameras, it seemed initially, when it was starting to come out, it seemed initially like this could be the solution to a lot of problems. And there are admittedly, there are arguments to be made for not having mandatory on body cameras in a couple of situations, especially involving people who've suffered from various forms of sexual abuse and things like that. And I totally understand that. But then also, even having the cameras, if they're given control of the footage and when it comes out, or whether it accidentally turned off, or if it broke, or if we forgot to put it on that day, suspiciously seems to happen in a lot of cases, then it's not actually going to fix all the problems. And we can't allow ourselves, while it might be a good thing to add to our arsenal in terms of getting a little bit of justice out of the criminal justice system, we can't assume that it's going to fix all the problems.
It is a tool. We need to be very careful that it is simply a tool. So if it's in the hands of the police, it is their tool. Understand, I spent months and months and months with a camera in my hand as an undercover narcotics detective, and that camera was my weapon against the population that I was enforcing laws on. It is a tool, and whoever is in control of it will use it as their weapon, as police will do going forward. And I've been warning incessantly, because if they're in control, you combine that with facial recognition software, you're doing mass warrant searches, your private privacy is completely out the window, because again, you're not controlling your police department. They work for a mayor, and legislators are doing the exact opposite. They are crafting legislation to ensure that video doesn't get released.
Yeah. Well, actually, why don't we continue on from there? Because this next story actually ties into that. The company formerly known as Taser is already a gigantic player in the police body camera business, and they've got some potentially scary plans about how they would like that technology to be used in the future. I want to give credit to Ava Kaufman of The Intercept for initially publishing some of the details from a technology report released a little bit ago by Taser, from which we're getting some of this information. But before we jump to the implications going forward, let's go just a little bit back earlier this year, where it was revealed that a Taser was going to provide any police department that wants it free body cameras, along with a year of free data storage, training, and support. That's obviously a massive investment, and so it might seem a little bit odd. What are they getting out of this? And you'll find out very soon. It turns out that they actually store terabytes upon terabytes of this video at evidence.com in private servers operated by Microsoft, to which police agencies must continuously subscribe for a monthly fee. So it's hardly a philanthropic thing to give them the body cameras if they're being paid off massively to hold the footage. But that's probably the least problematic part of this. In February, the company acquired a computer vision startup called Dextro and a computer vision team from Fossil Group Inc. Taser says the companies will allow agencies to automatically redact faces to protect privacy, so that sounds good initially, extract important information, and detect emotions and objects, all without human intervention. Analytics will also allow departments to observe historical patterns and behavior for officer training. So they're compiling this massive database of all the footage coming in from these police body cameras, and they now have the technology to analyze it without needing a human presence. So they can go through it very fast, looking for certain bits of information to train officers. But what about in the future? Well, the company has explicitly said that it will not make predictions on behalf of customers based on the analytics of that data. But that's not what their technology report that came out earlier this year actually said. It said, we may not be quite at the Tom Cruise minority level report of cognitive prediction. Well, that's good. But patterns of individual behavior will become increasingly informative in revealing the probability that an individual will act in a particular fashion. And as our data sets become even bigger, the analytical algorithms will become ever more sophisticated in revealing robust patterns. It is inevitable that predictive policing will expand. I don't view this to be a bad thing, and it's consistent with Taser's two principles, protect life, protect truth, and then they go on to talk about innocent citizens' privacy being protected. But of course, if you're gathering tens of thousands of body cameras a day, analyzing it with AI, trying to predict who will be committing crimes in the future, and this sort of technology is flawed. They're not going to be able to predict necessarily. Is this going to be another source for cops to be unnecessarily afraid of certain people? If some computer program tells them that this sort of person is a little bit more likely to be violent or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, of course. I want to throw a few other points into this to highlight them. I really liked where you were going. The data storage question is whose data? I keep telling you, they don't work for you. The police work for Taser in this instance. Mm-hmm. It's their data and training to do what? Support Taser's goals. And so this is what we're going forward. And this is from Taser, which is the Taylor A. Swift electric rifle. So we don't really point out what it actually is. It's an electronic rifle, which has killed over 500 people. Mm-hmm. And when you say, how did it get this way? How did we finally find ourselves that cops want these tasers everywhere? Well, when I was in logistics in the Baltimore Police Department, and there's a couple of other reports you can find out there, that Taser was giving stock options to police officers for convincing their police departments to adopt the taser. Literally buying them off.
So you're worried that that could potentially be a conflict of interest?
You would think. I don't know. Maybe if they're working for private industry and they're working for mayors, they're not working for you. This is what I keep screaming from the rafters, and I'm waiting for the day we can finally make that change.
Well, it sounds a lot like the pharmaceutical companies going into doctor's offices and telling them to push incredibly dangerous drugs in exchange for payoffs of various types.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's this trope now that, you know, if you eliminate human discretion and just sort of automate these processes by way of an algorithm or by way of these kind of big data procedures that people are so excited about, you kind of eliminate the potential that human bias can become a factor, or that data can be misappropriated to unduly penalize certain groups. But when the data is in the hands of a private firm whose motive is profit, in concert with police departments who have a whole variety of incentives that they're working under, depending on the political situation in their jurisdiction, then of course that's going to become imbued with bias. Because the people who are running that system that they're incorporating these kind of big data protocols into are working within a system that in which bias is sort of inherent to it.
Yeah.
So this is far from a panacea. If anything, it's sort of raises the idea that it could actually be used to further surveil people rather than, you know, free them from the constraints of, you know, officious law enforcement authorities.
Yeah. I like body cameras being a little bit more broadly used on cops. I would like that to be deployed in tandem with a more of an ability for people to have access to that information. Obviously, tasers have killed hundreds of people. But in a lot of cops' hands, I'd prefer them to have the taser than a gun because they seem like they're going to shoot one or the other.
Fair point.
So I guess there's some good that could theoretically come out of this. But in terms of like trying to predict who's going to commit crimes, I have a lot of faith in technology. but I don't have a lot of faith in humans necessarily, and I don't know that I have a lot of faith in a company that watched Minority Report and RoboCop and thinks that those are good examples of how policing should develop into the future. That's scary, not just in terms of a police analysis, but movie analysis. I don't know what movie you watched that you derived that lesson. So this is potentially scary. This gets into, I mean, this is the plan in 2017, in 10 years, in 20 years. This could be dystopic shit.
We have an Orwellian model of policing. I mean, I keep trying to say that when our answer to force is that the state must have more force, but we have the Second Amendment that says we must be able to have equal force. Well, you get into the police. Mm. It started in LA. The police needed more force from the bank shootout. So that's when the realization came. So then they just keep up. We Second Amendment rights, we get to have tanks. Well, then we get to have bigger tanks. Well, then we get to have armor. So it's going to continue to be that way, where we end up with MRAPs on our streets, like we see, and we end up with private dogs attacking Native Americans on their own treaty land. This will continue. And now, if you want to combine cameras on everything, if this doesn't scare you, I don't know what can possibly scare you to let that tool in the hands of a fascist regime that we have.
And look at what else Taser brags that it has the capacity to do now in this report, which was described in the Intercept. They claim that they'll be able to, quote, anticipate criminal activity and, quote, predict future events. And they can do this in part by just knowing automatically if somebody has a criminal record. So if somebody's just walking down the street and an officer deems them sufficiently suspicious that they can run some kind of analytical check on them, they don't even have to interact with that person to get a whole portfolio of their past behavior. So, you know, if they were convicted of driving without a license 15 years ago, that can hypothetically be used as a justification, even if it's not conscious on the officer's part, but it can factor into whether the officer chooses to initiate an interaction with that person. Like, and as I mentioned earlier, that always has the possibility of escalating into something that could even become fatal.
Yeah.
So it's really disturbing.
If Skynet decides, oh, that guy could potentially be dangerous, you're trying to predict the future, but you're leaving out what effect the cop dealing with the guy will actually have on the event. And so that's a great point too. Look, it's interesting. It's also theoretically incredibly scary. And we do need a lot of reform for the police. I don't know that this is the right direction for them to be going in. Anyway, we should probably take our first break. Hopefully you've been tweeting at us at hashtag TYT Live about the stories that we've discussed. We will be back after this short break. Welcome back to the show, everybody. It's John and the two mics, which people noticed and tweeted about, actually. So I'm going to read a couple of those. El Duende Chingon says, it's almost a poem. Sure, they're short ashore, but two mics is mighty nice. That's good. I can see that catching on. We just need to get an Ike on the table. Okay, that would really complete it. Let's see. Rafer Madness says, I was a teenager once. I drank underage. I even made noise sometimes. Not once was I shot at by a cop. P.S. I'm white and Canadian. So both of those things probably worked in your favor in that area. And Gabby Marita says, so two people also responded to the Taser story. Gabby Marita says, nobody tell Taser about the Borg from Star Trek. I super duper don't want them taking notes from the Borg Queen. I, as a nerd, like that. And then Sean Ferris says, I like the scene in RoboCop where he shoots the corrupt oligarch who secretly ran Detroit. That was good times. So good analysis there. I think they should go work for Taser. And you wanted to
give
a shout out.
So myself and others in the TYT crew were in Washington, D.C. this past weekend for the White House Correspondents' Dinner counter-programming events that TYT was involved in. And we got to meet a lot of great viewers and supporters. So I just wanted to give a quick shout out to a couple of them. First is Ray and Miguel from Rockville, Maryland. Hello. And also Barb from Philly, hello to you as well. And that'll do it.
Nice. Speaking of DC, by the way, I'm going to be leaving tomorrow. I'm going to be moderating a panel on the Tyler Award for Environmental Achievement, which I think we might be live streaming, but I'm not 100% sure. But the award is going to a biologist from Mexico named Jose Saracan Kermes, who helped to push the Mexican government to shut down a massive deforestation that was happening in the Veracruz area and had a great impact on the biological diversity in that area. So hopefully you're gonna learn a lot from him, and we will hopefully also make it available to you. Other scientists as well. With that, why don't we jump back into the stories? Although few seem to have noticed it and fewer still are talking about it, the Republicans in Congress are actually working on a bill, the Financial Choice Act, that would strip away most of the substantive Wall Street reforms that we were able to get, the few we were able to get after the Great Recession not so long ago. In this video, we're going to break down some of the highlights of it, starting with this. It would weaken the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau by moving it under the control of the executive branch. Currently, it's an independent agency. It would be under the purview of the president from now on. And in fact, the president could unilaterally choose to remove the head of it, a power they don't currently have. Now, that is an organization, obviously, that has won major battles in terms of credit card fees and things like that. It protects the consumers when it comes to the financial sector. And we had a long battle to get it set up in the first place. Now, it might still exist under this, but it seems like it'd be partially defanged.
Well, if you have, anytime you have an at-will employee, essentially, for a mayor or for a commissioner or for a president, they're not actually working for anybody. They're a direct representation of the president. So that's all that it'd be now, is a complete mouthpiece for the executive branch if they pass this, for obvious reasons that if they don't say exactly what the president wants them to say, well, then goodbye, you're gone. So whenever you have appointments, it's all a moot point.
I also think people should just be kind of intrinsically wary that any of these big Republican initiatives that get bandied about have any real likelihood to get passed. Mm-hmm. Because the Republican Party has shown itself to not be a coherent governing unit at this point, mm-hmm. at least within Congress. We saw that with healthcare. We saw it with other issues. And then you had just yesterday, so you have Republicans in Congress working on this bill to deregulate Wall Street. And then just yesterday, Trump gave like a blitz of interviews. And at one point, he said that he is considering reinstating Glass-Steagall and breaking up the big banks. Now, who knows if that rhetoric is actually tethered to anything of substance, but it still shows how complicated this process is, even within the GOP, to come up with some kind of unified policy program.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, but in his interviews, he also said that the current AHCA protects those with pre-existing conditions. So it's entirely possible that he has no idea what's actually going on, which plays to your point. It's not coherent. And you're right. It's entirely possible that this could fail. A lot of their biggest legislative goals so far have failed. We were worried that the Obamacare repeal possibly could go through in this latest round. Doesn't look like that's going to happen. In this case, I think there's a higher chance, because I think there's fewer Republicans who are willing to go against it in this case. It's an issue that people talk about less. The public opinion isn't as strong in regard to it, keeping the protections, that I think something like pre-existing conditions and things like that.
But so, we should think about how this is all part of that system I'm always harping on about how they tie into one another. So for instance, with the housing bubble we had before and the deregulation and that aspect, there were a lot of black communities that had up to 70% of their wealth taken from them. So then when you talk about how a system entirely oppresses, well, the point of these deregulations is to get profit from the poor to the rich. That is the entire point of deregulating it, to cut that out. So then you oppress people more and marginalize them more, calling thus need, obviously we need more police to come and control these poor people who are trying to actually get a piece of their pie.
It's a system that works quite well in that way.
You know, it's a lot harder to personalize kind of obscure financial regulations as opposed to, say, healthcare, where lots of people know somebody with a pre-existing condition if they don't have one themselves. So I think you're right that there's a possibility that it could be easier to placate members of the Republican caucus. We don't have to worry about constituents getting as agitated about this as they did healthcare. But at the same time, I think it's just generally people ought to be wary about how dysfunctional the Republican caucus is at this point when they talk about these proposals and whether they could actually be implemented in law.
I never underestimate the value of stupid.
Exactly. Or if it is actually passed, some of this might well not be in it. Yeah, that's entirely true. Right. But just in case, let's go over a few more. And as we go through these, bear in mind that the organization that theoretically would be around to protect you after these changes, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, is not really going to exist afterward. But we have fun little bits like eliminating the Volcker Rule, which bars commercial banks from engaging in certain types of risky or speculative investments. And many people feel like it was that sort of behavior that contributed strongly to the Great Recession. You've got the weakening of the too big to fail tests currently in place for banks that could prove to be a systemic risk to the entire economic system. Also doubles the time between those tests and takes away any consideration of what are considered qualitative measures of whether a bank is too big to fail outside of just the bottom line. It also removes the ability of the federal government to liquidate banks that are judged to be too big to fail. So whether the test is there or not largely becomes irrelevant once they can't actually do anything about it. And on a personal level, it would allow banks and credit card agencies to increase debit and credit card fees possibly in a large way. And look, there's a lot of people that day to day, that's how you interface economically with the world is through debit and credit cards, and that money can really add up.
Yeah, speaking about sometimes too, with the, you think about the debit cards for welfare programs, for example, mm-hmm. when they increase those yeah. transaction fees, those come out of those payments
in
a direct ciphering of benefits to those rich people again. It's all designed yeah. for this. It's so frustrating to keep seeing it in so many avenues.
Yeah, it actually it's switching a little bit of welfare from the people who need it to the banks.
And actually, the issue with fees in terms of credit cards and debit cards, that actually is an avenue through which you could potentially personalize
exactly, yeah.
this sort of issue rather than talking in abstract terms about regulation and even the Consumer Protection Bureau is a little
yeah.
hard for an ordinary person to grasp the meaning of, but everybody kind of understands intuitively what increased fees yeah. on their credit card means.
Yeah, so start talking about overdraft protection again. Mm-hmm. Like, we got that thanks to the CFPB. Like, we didn't used to have that. I was hit once by dipping down below. Oh my, the financial industry, the way, if you have a whole bunch of, I used to live on the brink every month. I grew up poor. And so if you dip down below the amount of money you have, they would reorient the timing of your purchases so that as many as possible trigger afterwards. So you get charged the fee as many times as possible. That is the sort of bullshit that used to be legal and thankfully right now isn't. But perhaps we're being too hard on them because Representative Jeb Hensarling, Republican, says that we're getting it all wrong. There's a reason that they're going to be taking away these protections. It has nothing to do with banks. He says, regrettably, thanks to Dodd-Frank, too many garages in our nation are full of old cars instead of new startup small businesses. It's time for the bailouts to end. It's time to help small businesses on Main Street. Yes, because if I were to clear out my garage, which I don't have, and fill it with a startup, I'd be worried about capital requirements for massive banks. And so when I read that, I thought, well, that's interesting. He seems really passionate about this. I wonder if theoretically there's any financial reason that he'd be saying the sorts of things he did. And so I looked up the donor information for him for 2015, 2016. Those are his top donors. Securities and investment, commercial banks, miscellaneous finance. And there you're talking about nearly $1 million, which is a gigantic portion of all of the money that Hensarling actually raised between 2015 and 2016. So take his comments with a big old grain of salt. Yeah, however, I hope that you're right and it doesn't pass.
Yeah, the thing with Hensarling is interesting because, you know, there's one way to interpret his donations there as just outright corruption. He's basically sacrificing whatever principles he might have had to satisfy his donors. But I think in his case, he just views the financial services industry to somehow be inherently virtuous mm-hmm. and consistent with his.
Do you think it works in the opposite direction?
I just don't think he's necessarily being swayed in one direction or another. He's just kind of like, he naturally has this view that, you know, enriching mm-hmm. these people is somehow sound political strategy and morally sound. So, I mean, that's even in a sense an even worse problem.
Yeah, some people are just true believers. I mean, I guess you could try to pay off someone and switch their opinion up, but if you instead simply install people who agree with you already and keep the cash flowing, maybe that's cheaper in the long run.
Yeah, it's like reinforcing a pre-existing position.
Exactly. Same area, moving, going a little bit more specific. Jared Kushner right now is perhaps one of the most influential people in the White House. We don't know exactly how, since he never has to talk about what he actually does there. He just every week has a new gigantic responsibility put on his back. Thankfully, he's a 36-year-old who only has experience in the real estate industry, so I'm sure he's going to do a good job there. But in addition to being influential, he also unfortunately is plagued with a really spotty memory, and he keeps forgetting to disclose important things like having over $1 billion in loans out from some of the biggest banks in the world, banks that his influence could possibly influence. So this was originally released, revealed by the Wall Street Journal. He failed to identify his part ownership of Cadre, a real estate startup that he founded, which links him to both Goldman Sachs and also spanning the divide there in mega investors politically, George Soros and Peter Thiel. So that's a big organization there that he hadn't actually talked about. But perhaps more importantly, he failed to identify debt of more than $1 billion from 20 lenders and personal guarantees to pay more than $300 million of that. Now, sometimes you forget about some money. It slips between the cushions and the couch and you forget that it was there. I would have remembered the $1 billion. And what's important out of this is that A source told the Journal that Kushner planned to recuse himself from anything that concerned Deutsche Bank and RBS, two of the banks he owes money to. So that's good that we now find out that he was going to willingly recuse himself without revealing that he had a possible conflict of interest. But that's just two of the banks, and he still owes money to Bank of America, the Blackstone Group, which is a massive investment firm, Citigroup, UBS, and Deutsche Bank and RBS. So he can possibly be whispering in Trump's ear, in other Republicans' ears, crafting policy that affects these banks. And we only now are finding out that he theoretically has a couple $100 million of reason to go easy on them.
Man, they are a different class of people.
They're rich.
$1 billion in loans at that age, yeah. That's hard to wrap yourself around and how that's a different class. It's clearly showing how money is controlling everything in our politics. What more do you want than other to see that this is what has arisen from our current situation? I don't know how we continue to have this ignorance or willful ignorance that we're being controlled by a bunch of other people that have our interests not anywhere in their minds.
One aspect of the story that I really love, because it's so emblematic of just the bipartisan corruption that Kushner sort of represents, is that the attorney who is representing him and giving statements to the media to kind of rationalize the conduct and talk about how they're going to be addressing it is Jamie Gorelick. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're familiar with who Jamie Gorelick is, she is a Democrat. She was the deputy attorney general under Bill Clinton in the 1990s. And she also was involved in the 9/11 commission in the mid-2000s. So she is not a right-wing fire breather. She is basically a Wall Street corporate Democratic Democrat type. And it's part of the reason why that there's such a right-wing revolt now against Kushner and other people in the White House who they see as not being in line with Trump's sort of nationalist populist agenda. Because obviously Kushner is comfortable with people like Gorelick, and it makes sense because Kushner was a Democrat. His family were Democratic donors. They gave a ton of money to Hillary Clinton. So
he's about the money. He doesn't really care ideologically where they come from.
Right. So
and Bill Clinton had massive corruption, especially later on in his presidency. There was the foreign money scandals and all that. So I'm not surprised to find someone who's okay with that, having dwelled there. Yeah. Yeah, and look, the sums are just huge. I mean, we're used to politicians being bought off for a couple of $1 million or something like that. That's just run of the mill. That's a regular congressman. Only $1 billion and having hundreds of millions of dollars outstanding, and that's just one of them. And I have to wonder where the information is coming from. We've been talking for several weeks now about the split between Kushner and Bannon. I mean, the fact that specifically the information linking into George Soros came out makes me think that maybe Bannon is involved in this. I don't have any evidence of that, but I imagine the right wing is going to go crazy when they find out that they're financially linked.
I mean, his money is kind of the example where his money doesn't care about left or right. Left or right is the dynamic that they've tricked us all into believing, so we argue with one another. These are all the same people. It's almost as if Obama would be going to Wall Street right now to give a speech, and all the money would be coming from the same people.
It's almost like that.
The Soros connection is just hilarious, because Soros, as we all know, is just kind of this omniscient bugaboo that helps explain every kind of right-wing grievance.
So have you not been paid by Soros for the protests you've gone to?
No comment.
You went to a town hall recently. Were you paid by Soros to do that?
No comment.
Okay. So I'm going to say yes, you were.
No, but it's just funny, because now they have to kind of configure the Soros into their narrative about Soros' nefarious interest. They have to incorporate the fact that Soros is apparently operating within the White House at the highest levels. And, and Kushner is an advisor who, under no circumstances, sans divorce from Ivanka, could ever be done away with.
Yeah.
So, if you're somebody who thinks Soros is this singularly destructive figure in U.S. politics, you kind of have to reconcile yourself with the fact that apparently Trump's closest advisor didn't have any compunction about doing dealings with him. And how does that kind of alter your perception of how this stuff works?
Yeah. Oh, you think they're going to analyze it?
That was at that level. I think they're just going to get really mad for a little bit.
Perhaps.
But I wish they'd go in your direction. With that, we're going to have to go to our second break. When we come back, we're going to have an update on the possibility of healthcare reform being passed. And we're also going to find out what you are doing to give yourself pre-existing conditions and why you're such a bad person for it after this. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Just a little bit more for you. It's John and Mike and Mike. One more story we're going to jump right into because we unfortunately don't have much more time. Right now, there's still the possibility that the repeal and replacement of Obamacare could go through. And under the current version of the Republican bill, protections for pre-existing conditions have been largely made irrelevant. That's something that most Americans don't actually support. But there's a certain Republican congressman, Mo Brooks, who doesn't really get what all the fuss is about. And he has a very interesting argument to back that up, which you're going to see in this clip.
My understanding is that it will allow insurance companies to require people who have higher health care costs to contribute more to the insurance pool that helps offset all these costs, thereby reducing the cost to those people who lead good lives, they're healthy, they've done the things to keep their bodies healthy. And right now, those are the people who have done things the right way that are seeing their costs skyrocketing. Now, in fairness, a lot of these people with pre-existing conditions, they have those conditions through no fault of their own. And I think our society under those circumstances needs to help.
So he acknowledges that some of these pre-existing conditions are not caused by your sinful ways. You simply are born with them or you develop them through the act of living. And our society should protect those people. So I would say to him, then leave the protection the way it is, because that's what the bill actually does. It protects those people. Like, there are babies who are born with congenital heart defects or cancer as they're born. All of those things. And currently, they are protected. They can get health insurance and it's relatively affordable. Under the new bill, their premiums could be jacked up. Individual, like, there was one of the treatments for cancer, an analysis showed that it could end up costing more than $150,000. And it's currently a couple thousand dollars under this. And so if he's being honest and he actually believes we should protect these people, then he can't possibly defend this bill.
You're gonna have to comment on this. We're a morally corrupt, like, society. I don't know how we
the good even, lives like, thing is what got you.
Like, how do we discuss morally corrupt principles of, like, if you've done all you can and something happens to you and you are screwed from something? Oh, well, you know what? Yeah, we have this country we call great, but we're not gonna care about you whatsoever. Yeah. Let you go about your way. Like, I don't know. I don't know how we. I'm ashamed.
Yeah, and that's the part of family values too.
And just on a practical level, last I checked, which as of an hour or so ago, there were 20 House Republicans who are firm no's on the bill, which seems to indicate that the margin might even be even more lopsided this time around in terms of the bill failing to get through the Republican caucus as it was a couple weeks ago. You even have staunch conservatives like Billy Long, a congressman from Missouri, Don Young, congressman from Arkansas, who are opposed either firmly or leaning that they're opposed. So it seems like this is sort of a fanciful notion that this could even get through the House, never mind the Senate. So I think the way that the pre-existing condition issue is personalized is just sort of going to impede the Republicans' ability to get anything resembling this current iteration of the bill through.
That's a good point. It seems like with maybe this medical issue that we can finally get people to understand that did vote for Trump because they are economically impoverished and oppressed in a certain way, that we aren't different teams. Like, go out there and convince your congressman that this is what needs to be changed because this directly affects you. Maybe you can't see that whole big picture in how the system interacts, but this is a primary example of how they're separating all of us at the bottom and just oppressing us as a group, and we are the same team.
Trying to pit us against each other. Right. Yeah, and I'm glad. I mean, I'm always shocked when they stand up and actually do vote against something like this, but perhaps it's just that protecting those with pre-existing conditions is one of the most popular things that's been passed under Obama. It seemed insane to me that they couldn't pass the original version of the bill. And so they changed it up to strip out protections for all the most popular parts of it. And that was their strategy to get it passed, to convince moderates to go ahead. Now, they did get some of the Freedom Caucus and all that. They got all that, but they still need some of those moderates. And so far, they don't seem to be able to convince them.
It's ironic because this whole process sort of vindicates one of the conservative criticisms of Obamacare when it was originally being considered in 2009, which was that once you have an entitlement program in place, it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to actually repeal it or take it away from people who are benefiting from its services. And that's made manifest by even Republicans from some of the most conservative districts in the country not being willing to relinquish these one of these protections for their constituents.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right. I mean, historically, it seems like the only way you can get around that is if it's in a quote unquote entitlement program that generally only affects the poor. Then you can strip money out of it theoretically. But yeah, thankfully, it seems like there's broad approval of these sorts of things currently around the country. And that is definitely good news. I know we're not going to talk about it at length, but I'm sure most of the people watching this have seen Jimmy Kimmel talking about the experience of his child and trying to come to grips with what it would have been like if he had not been a millionaire and had gone through that situation, that the prospect of possibly losing his child. If we go back to the way things were, hopefully some of you didn't have to get health insurance back before Obamacare. It was a rough situation in a lot of different ways. There was a lot of good documentaries back then that broke it down. So hopefully we won't go back in that direction. But unfortunately, we do have to end the show. So I want to thank both of you.
Thank you, John. Follow me at Michael A. Wood Jr. on Twitter. That'd be the best way to get the information. We got a lot of stuff coming out here soon.
Yeah.
And don't follow me.
It's too many people boring.
Following. Yeah, don't follow.
Don't bother being followed. If you can find me, you can follow me. Okay, but I leave it to you. Do some Googling. Anyway, second hour is coming up after this. Continue to tweet at hashtag TYT Live. We'll get them to read some of those when we come back from this break.